listening is spending a lot of time really understanding what are they concerned about and not just brushing it off. And, you know, a lot of what I was saying was like, you know me. You know what we're doing here. Kind of trust. Can you trust me? And they did, and they went along with us.
Hey, and welcome to the Role Models Podcast. I'm David Noel. Role Models is a series of conversations with inspiring people. We capture and share the stories and career path of the people we look up to, how they got to where they are, the lessons learned along the way, and the challenges they've tackled. My guest in this episode is Kate Burson. Instead of becoming a professional tennis player, Kate helped rewrite the Constitution of the Republic of Georgia, and as an assistant attorney general, worked on solving the largest financial fraud case in the history of the United States. And then she joined the governor of the state of New York and created her own job as a chief of staff to drive and implement public energy policies in the state of New York. Today, Kate leads the Northeast market development for Tesla and is leading a transition from being a car company to an energy company. This is the Role Models Podcast, and this is episode 2, and this is Kate Burson. Kate, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate your time. Kate, there's a profile in 2015 on Politico that dubbed you the public energy connector of the New York State. And I want to get back to this later on, but maybe we could start by you telling us a little bit about where you're from and if you could describe your childhood.
I'm originally from Tennessee and grew up with an older sister, about 4 years older. Had an amazing childhood. I got to run around in the trees and play with my friends, and was in Memphis, and then we moved to Nashville when I was about 9 years old. Childhood. What? Got to play a lot.
Why did you move to Nashville?
We moved to Nashville because my dad got a great job, and he was a lawyer, and he was appointed to become the state attorney general, which is the kind of the prosecutor for the state. And that was his dream job of the moment, and he was always really committed to public service and government and politics. And so he took a big pay cut, and we all moved to Nashville.
Is this where your interest then for later public service emerged, or is this, did this come later?
I think it was just always a part of who I was and part of who my kind of part of my family. It started with my grandparents, and specifically my grandmother, my dad's mother, who became the first female state commissioner. She was the commissioner for labor in Tennessee. And my dad fell in love with politics and different civil issues, and it then infected me as well.
Mm. How did you, how old were you when your grandmother became the first female state commissioner?
I was not alive.
Oh, you were not alive yet. Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
But it influenced then later on the family, the family overall.
Yes.
And can you talk a bit about the early influences of your childhood? Like you ended up, or you started off actually, your first career seemed to be a tennis player, right? So, and then later on you did a switch into law, and then later on into energy, the energy industry. So how the early passion and interest for tennis, where did this come from? And talk a little bit about that.
Well, tennis was a big part of my life from the time I was 7 until I was 22. And as a kid, I loved to just play and play every sport and be very active. And I played everything. And then at some point, I think my father decided I should be a professional tennis player. And all the other sports started to drop off. And tennis became very much my my life. And I actually did not have a passion for it. And so it was very... It that experience still really shapes my life. So I guess for about 15 years, I was playing this sport and having it control my life, and I didn't like it.
Mm-hmm. At what age did you realize you didn't like it?
I think it started coming out more in high school. And it wasn't that I guess that I disliked it, but that I wanted more. And I think I've started to understand the issue more as I've gotten older, because I've seen some of the patterns repeat themselves. I mean, part of it, I think the biggest piece for me with tennis is I'm very much a team person. And so I loved soccer and basketball and volleyball. And tennis was a very isolating, lonely sport. So when I played, when I got to university and played in college, it was, I enjoyed it a lot more than I did growing up.
How was this for you when your dad decided that this is going to be your professional career? Like, what was going on in your mind there? And let's go a level deeper on that.
I don't know that he actually, that there was a moment. And I want to be clear, I am, which will come out later, but I'm very close with my parents, and we're all figuring this out as we go along in life. It was clear that I should prioritize tennis. I experienced that for the first time when I was 7 or 8 years old, and I picked going to my best friend's birthday party over going to a tennis tournament that I, for which I had qualified. And I got to go to my friend's birthday party, but I learned that it would please my dad more if I had gone to the tennis tournament. So I made those decisions, as I grew up to go the tennis route. And it wasn't really, I kind of followed others' lead. They believed in me, and I didn't, I followed.
Mm-hmm. And when did you stop playing?
I stopped playing as soon as I graduated college.
And where did you go to college?
I went to Vanderbilt University. And I went there as a female tennis player in the United States. At least when I went, it was kind of the best sport to excel at, to get a full ride to university. So I was very fortunate to get in and be able to go to pretty much any university that I wanted. There's a difference between the Ivy League schools. They didn't really give full athletic scholarships versus the non-Ivies. And in the end, I chose Vanderbilt it was a great school. I was going to go to a great academic school. But I really chose it because the coach at Vanderbilt was my tennis coach growing up. And he was a really important person in my life. And I kind of wanted to go through this journey with him.
What made him important?
He was very passionate about tennis, which, it's nice to be around people with passion. But what I really gravitated towards was the other parts of him. Very smart, master's in English, curious about the world. And in my tennis travels, I didn't find that often. And so here's this person who's going to coach you, who saw me as more than just a tennis player and who wanted to have conversations about more than tennis. And he also had taken a very different career path. My father in particular, he was a lawyer and was very traditional professional in that way. And my tennis coach was not taking the traditional career path, and he was married to also this very intelligent, accomplished woman who was a poet. But I was curious about different ways to live and to excel. So, and
he helped you open up to the horizon through those conversations.
Yeah.
And so you studied law, right?
Yes.
Why did you decide to study law?
I think that it was kind of one of these. There was. It's not that simple. It wasn't. I didn't have some people with whom I went to university had a very clear idea of what they wanted to do. My best friend, we grew up together playing tennis. She lived in another state, but from the time we were nine, she knew, basically exactly the type of doctor she wanted to be and how many kids she wanted to have and all of those things. And I just kind of always had this sense that I want to make things better, and I didn't really know the form that it would take. And I came from a family basically split of lawyers and artists. And I also like kind of keeping doors open. So when it was time to go to graduate school, I was looking at public policy, international relations, and law, and really felt that law was going to kind of give me the education to understand the way the system worked, and also give me lots of opportunities when I finished.
Can you describe a little bit when you said it was not that easy, it was a little bit more complicated than that, the choice, the decisions to go for law? Because I was in a similar situation where before going to university, I wasn't quite sure what are my different options and what is the world like out there? And it's a big decision you take. And I was surrounded by friends who knew exactly what kind of doctor they wanted to become, and they had this path, and I felt like something was wrong with me, not knowing. Can you describe a bit what was going on inside of you when you're thinking around about making this decision? Because it'd be interesting for our listeners to hear a bit like the thought process behind that.
Yeah, so it was a journey that started really when I was, a junior in college, and I had this moment. I was probably, I was about 20, where I kind of, had a little bit of an identity crisis, and that was when I acknowledged that I didn't like tennis and I was playing for other people and was trying to please others. And so I really kind of took a step back. People viewed me in our community as, oh, I was going to be a politician and I was going to go to law school. And I realized I didn't know what I wanted, and that I kind of let the views of others shape my trajectory. So I was really fortunate at that point in life to have a wonderful tennis coach, wonderful parents who were able to talk through all this with me, and great professors and friends that really helped me get through this. And so I needed to step back. I figured at that point in time I was kind of supposed to go to law school. And so I actually wanted to give myself space before making that decision to kind of figure out, what do I want? And my parents were very supportive of that. And my whole life I'd spent on the tennis court, basically, and hadn't gotten the chance to work over summers like other people. And so actually after college, I set up 4 different internships that I was going to use to help me figure out what my next step would be. I had a general sense of what I wanted to do based on college. I was very interested in sustainable development and kind of how do we create these more win-win environments. And so I didn't really know what that looked like as a career. So I set up internships at the World Wildlife Fund, the World Trade Organization, actually the National Women's Law Center. And then I did some corporate social responsibility consulting. And in that time, I realized, you know, I want to go to law school. I don't know what it's going to look like in the end, but I think this is the right next step for me.
So were those 4 internships for you the space that you stepped into to figure out what it was? Or was there, if there's people who are in a similar situation and you were when you were 20, what is the best piece of advice you can give them to take a step back and explore that space?
Let yourself do it. I experienced it then and I still experience it today. You need to sometimes press a pause button and think, but it feels like there's a lot of pressure to just always have an answer. And pushing pause is weak or wrong. For me, it's only helped me. So, I mean, to the extent you can, and I think that looks different for everyone, to give yourself space to figure out what your next step is.
In those internships, what was the most unusual experience or the most profound learning that you've gained in one of these 4 internships?
I think there was a very professional one for me, where I'd always very strongly believed in the role of government to solve problems. And I guess especially in my World Trade Organization and the World Wildlife Fund work, I started seeing kind of more clearly the role of corporations and felt like, well, corporations are actually much larger than governments and they cross all these borders. And it's actually through corporations that maybe we can make things better, faster. So that really kind of changed my professional lens a little bit. I think both in those internships and then when I was in law school, I had a really powerful work experience. And I worked actually in the Republic of Georgia and was doing civil liberties work there. And so I'd say from all of those, I actually felt like the environment I was in was almost much more powerful and the learnings deeper than the actual work I was doing. Sometimes as an intern, you know, your work is only so helpful, but the larger experience of living in these different environments, interacting with all the different people, I think gave me something that maybe my resume wouldn't quantify, and helps me in everything I do.
Talk a little bit more about that experience in Georgia. So for people who don't know where Georgia is, it's not the state, not the U.S. state, Georgia, but it's the republic in Eastern Europe. And civic liberties work. Talk a little bit more about that.
So
it takes a bit of courage to, you know, to step into this world and go away from home and then get involved into a movement which is happening, you know, halfway across the world.
It was exciting. I studied history in college, and especially was interested in the former Soviet Union. And it turns out in law school, one of my professor mentors had assisted the country with rewriting their constitution. And this was shortly after the Rose Revolution there. And this was the beginning of a new democracy. They were looking for law students to help them. So she reached out to me, and this was exactly the type of experience I wanted to have. And I was really interested in international development at the time. And the experience there was just, it left like more than a kind of thumbprint impression on my life. I feel like I can, work in, under the surface levels a lot more effectively now. And I guess just an example of that is, we in the West, as the wall came down, we're like, great, we're going to export democracy. And here are all these fabulously liberal, democratic, progressive laws. And we're going to put them in your constitution. And there you go. You're going to be just like us. And then on the ground, it's just fascinating. Like, these were laws that didn't fit their culture, their history, their norms. And it just seems so naive of us. I was working for the organization that helped lead the Rose Revolution and place the president in power, and a wonderful group of people. It just was very different. Once people have power, sometimes they change. And I also felt that the culture there and the people were fascinating. But I also found that I wasn't necessarily the right person to help there. I felt like a foreigner there more so than I felt in other work. I felt like an outsider. And it also, again, kind of revealed to me, I guess, the power of money and the power of power. And so I also, at that point, kind of pulled away a little bit from, kind of nonprofit international development work and international organizations, and started focusing more on how can I kind of have a positive impact through markets and through the bottom line, and started focusing more on social entrepreneurial efforts, impact investments, and whether they were local or international.
You came back and graduated then after that, your experience in Georgia?
Shortly after, I came back, and actually the next year got to work on a project in Madagascar, which was kind of a social entrepreneurial one and a very different experience. We were helping on the southeastern part of the island. We were trying to bring some level of improved economic development to the area through business, so that the people in the community didn't have to rely on deforestation and cutting down the trees in order to support themselves. And it was an incredibly powerful experience, and one that had there been money to be able to do it longer, I would have loved to have done that. But it brings up, I mean, there are lots of tensions between economic growth and environmental protection that we all continue to face.
Face every day. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Help us a bit. Like you came back and then one of your big milestones in your career was to become the assistant attorney general for the New York State, where you prosecuted securities fraud. What inspired that change to go from doing internship and, you know, different parts of the world and coming back and really focus your efforts in the local state level?
I was hoping to come out of law school and be able to do exactly what I wanted to do. And had done some work helping an investment group start that was going to be doing impact investing, and was talking to a variety of different institutions in that space, and was realizing that I needed to actually practice law for a few years or else I'd be kind of throwing away the value of my degree. And I will say this was a tension between my father and myself. To say he won probably isn't fair. I mean, I think he was actually right in this situation. And I had worked at a law firm one summer and really knew that that wasn't, I wasn't being true to myself. And I just, I wasn't going to do that. And so practicing in the public sector was very interesting to me. And that was really the only thing that I wanted to do. And I got to actually be an actor in the space at a time when the economy melted, and got to co-lead investigations, one relating to Bernie Madoff, who had, I guess, the largest Ponzi scheme in history, and also into the larger CDO, CDS work at the time.
So the instruments that took down the economy in 2008, 2009?
Correct, yeah. Yes. Yeah, so it was a great experience, but I also knew that I wanted to do something different, and was always driven by like wanting to find the win-win, and this was definitely not that environment. So
win-lose? Right?
There, yes, yes. But it was instrumental also in helping me see another side of the way the system works.
Yeah. From that phase, what would you say was your biggest learning? First foray into public sector.
Nothing is pure. Decisions have a lot of, competing drivers. Also learned to be very careful in what you write in emails. it was fascinating. I got to spend lots of time reading thousands and thousands of people's emails from 10 years before.
Nothing's pure.
Nothing's pure.
Okay, let's move on to the next phase. And the way it looks in your bio is that you then moved on to work with Governor Cuomo as a special assistant to the governor for the energy efficiency. Kind of a mouthful to speak it out. These titles in the public sector. How did you switch to work for the governor?
The governor had previously served as the state attorney general, and his time he was actually he and his advisors hired me for the at the Attorney General's office. So, and I had a 3-year commitment there, and I was about to leave to pursue something that was more aligned with my my professional interests of the time. When he became governor, and that group brought me with them and asked what I wanted to do. So, you know, there's so much that happens in a career that is like good fortune, luck, total luck, and kind of, you know, just taking that fork in the road. 'Cause I can say with the job at the Attorney General's office, I was very, very conflicted because it was not a direct route to what I wanted to do. And, you know, I see this every day with young people coming out of school. Well, I've done all this education. I'm ready to go. I want to change the world. And unfortunately, it's very difficult to just go directly into that change the world job. And I will say, actually, a piece of advice that I got, I think it was actually from my dad, when I was going to practice law, and I knew, and I was pretty clear with him, this is not what I want to do, was, you know, just do a really good job where you are and what you're doing, and, you know, keep fighting and doing things on the outside to get yourself exposed to the other things that you're interested in, and you'll get there. And, you know, actually, when I look back at his career, that's exactly what he did and how he got to do the work that he loved. I saw kind of another fork at the time when the governor and his team were moving to the Capitol and were giving me this option that even though I kind of knew I want to go and kind of have an impact through the marketplace and through corporations, I thought, well, I think there's a lot to learn here, and this is a great opportunity. So I agreed to move to Albany, New York, which is the state capital, and started working originally as an advisor on energy and environment. And environment was an area that I knew very well, and energy was new to me at the time. But shortly after, about 6 months in, I was pulled out to work directly for the governor. He wanted to figure out how to accelerate the adoption of energy efficiency in the state. It was seen at the time as a big kind of job creation engine and having the benefit of saving people money and helping the environment.
What's an example for that?
Of an energy efficiency project. Mm-hmm. So even putting extra insulation in homes and more efficient lighting, windows. I mean, Germany is actually has some of the most efficient homes. It's kind of just some really basic, and that's another piece to it. It was like, we don't need some technological revolution here.
It's all there.
It's all there, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, so I was asked to evaluate what we were doing and come forward with a plan for a new plan to get more out of what the state can do and more out of our money. And I guess the way that I'd say we had been doing it was, it's like we were standing on the street's corner telling people they should eat kale, and nobody wanted to eat kale. And we wanted to get more to where, oh, well, you just this food tastes great, and it happens to have kale in it. And part of my strategy was kind of how do we get from the traditional government programs where you just pay out rebates to really stimulating a marketplace and allowing for innovation and creative solutions to come in and take over.
The time with the governor was not finished after those 2 years, right? So in the political profile that I mentioned earlier in the beginning is mentioned or described the step to your next role. almost like that you created that job for yourself in a way, right? So talk a bit about, you became the chief of staff to the chairman of energy and finance for the state of New York, which is also often referred to as a czar. And the profile described that you convinced this czar, I think his name was Kaufman, right? To come to a meeting with Cuomo and convince both of them, convinced him to join the effort, and then for you to basically create your own role. Is that accurate?
Yeah. It's basically like that. I mean, as a next up after, as part of the previous role with the governor, I started to see a lot of missed opportunities in our work in energy, and believe that we could be doing something much larger and much more impactful. I would talk to the governor about it, and he got excited about it, and his advisors did as well. And I had heard, I'd met Richard Kaufman, I guess maybe about a year earlier, and was really impressed by him, not just as a great mind, but as a human, and just thought, if there's anybody who can help us achieve our potential and can really lead a transformation, it's this person. And on top of that, I want to work with this person. And so it did. I spent about 6 months recruiting him, and the governor wanted him on. And so we created basically a new structure, and we were overseeing all of the energy agencies and really managing kind of large bureaucracies and developing a new strategy for integrating renewable energy into the system and delivering more value.
What are some of the skills that you applied or learned in the process of recruiting Richard Kaufman over the period of 6 months to convince him to join the governor?
I learned patience. I learned to be gracious when getting an answer you don't want. I will say initially Richard turned us down, and I was crushed. I took the high road and said, well, I hope one day we get to work together. And shortly after, he came back. And I think those were two very important lessons.
I assume the work that, so in, over the course of your career, as in preparing for this, there were a bunch of things that somehow I think are recurring themes or underlying themes in being successful in your roles. And I think one of the things that you also mentioned on your profile is the management of stakeholders, right? So I think I assumed there was a lot of negotiation involved, a lot of persuasion involved in being successful in your job, and particularly in politics, where it's all about, building coalitions and compromising and winning people over. For people who are early in their career and who want to maybe understand a level deeper on what it means to manage stakeholders or to influence or to persuade, what advice can you share?
I think the number one thing is to listen to people and to really understand where they're coming from, what they need, what their driver is, and to, we all want to be heard and not just superficially. And there's something, I think the more genuine and, kind of respectful and understanding you are, whether it's to stakeholders or your own colleagues, the more that you will get out of it.
Can you describe listening? Because listening is, there's a superficial listening, right? Like I hear what you say. But then how do you get, what are tips and tricks to get to the deeper listening, more active listening?
So I can give an example. We were proposing in New York in a very radical change and had to get kind of very influential stakeholders to not just go screaming to the governor that we were crazy. And, you know, some of the stakeholders, they knew that we were coming from a good place, and that, say, take the environmental stakeholders, that, you know, the people running this were driven by climate change. This was not about, you know, anything else. And we were taking the direction of actually from a messaging standpoint, we were not actually leading with this is about climate change. We were leading from this is good business. These strategies are good business. And as a result, we'll have a cleaner environment. But it was a very different approach in a lot of ways. And these environmentalists we needed, they should have been our biggest allies, but all of the tactics were changing in that process. And so it was really, I mean, listening is spending a lot of time really understanding what are they concerned about and not just brushing it off. And, you know, a lot of what I was saying was like, you know me, you know what we're doing here, kind of trust, can you trust me? And they did, and they went along with us. What I've also learned coming out on the other side is, I mean, the reality was I wasn't going to be there forever. And, I mean, I did happen to leave before this transition was finished, which is, you know, it'll take probably, you know, could take up to 10 years before things are fully in place. And you get new people who come in to those roles and come into office. And so it is very scary. I see this, you know, exactly with the change of administration and the president, like so much authority was given to President Obama and that administration. And then all of a sudden, there's somebody new who comes into town and wants to do something very different. So, I don't know. I think it's spending a lot of time and really trying to understand each other so that you can do this together. That was my approach.
You mentioned trust. How do you get people to trust you?
I mean, just I can only speak for myself, obviously. I'm honest with people. I'm honest. I'm genuine. I will say I have internal conflict sometimes to think, oh, this isn't the way I'm supposed to do it. I'm supposed to be manipulative and hide things. And I need to play a larger game. But it's not my natural state. And I think whatever your natural, I guess I'd say whatever is natural to you. And maybe if that other thing is natural to you, then that is a good, that could work for you. But that's not how I do my best work.
The role of chief of staff is, I think it has such a nice ring to it. it sounds like a great and, fascinating role. Can you, explain a little bit what this role entails? How does one become a chief of staff? What is it? What is the role of it? Why should somebody pursue a position like this?
I mean, I think it's different. It's different in a lot of contexts. So you know, I don't know if anybody watched The West Wing, but, you know, the
big fan.
I mean, the chief of staff to the president is the ultimate advisor and is the one who helps get everything done. And, you know, that was very much what my role was working for Richard and in the governor's office. And, you know, I think in other places it could be more of an administrative role. My role with Richard, he really also treated me as a partner. And that was just very empowering. He listened to me. He asked for my advice. He'd say, just tell me what to do sometimes. And it was kind of a dream boss and colleague. And in this role, it was really about developing the strategy and hiring the team to execute on the strategy with us and managing the implementation. And so it was getting to both be at a very high level, but also in terms of the strategy setting, but also the management piece keeps you grounded to make sure that we're actually delivering on the strategy.
What would you say were the biggest challenges of this role and how did you tackle them?
I think the biggest challenges the biggest surprise and I think great learning experience was how fractions come up as implementation begins. So we had a very aligned kind of executive team on the strategy. And then as we got into the implementation, the divisions in philosophy and execution started to arise.
So it means implementation when a policy is agreed upon and acted on and to really bring it, to execute on it, to bring it to...
Right.
To life.
So this happens, and this was kind of one of the things that drove the creation of this group within the governor's office, is there's oftentimes you might set a policy, say, you know, say it's equal pay. That's great. There's legislation passed. But then it's so high level and vague and so many different ways to take it. And it's usually that piece of legislation is then directed to agencies to create regulations and to implement. And, you know, those that in the executive office who maybe created the policy are not usually involved in the day-to-day implementation. And so our group was unique in that we were creating the policy and then working with each of the agencies very closely in terms of how it was interpreted and how regulations and price signals needed to be designed. And so just to give kind of a little detail on what this was that we were doing, basically in the United States, and this is different in Europe, in order to get clean energy into the grid in New York, what we had been doing was just, we were providing subsidies and had some aspirational targets. But there was nothing really in the electric utility business model that was going to lead them to integrate clean energy into the system. And so it was basically like, renewable energy was just kind of a Band-Aid on the larger system, and energy efficiency was just this Band-Aid. It wasn't core to how the utility operated their system. So what we were working on was basically changing how utilities are compensated. And so to actually, they for about 100 years have been compensated to to spend capital to build out the electric grid, because that's what we needed. But now what we need is a cleaner electric grid, and a more efficient one, and a more resilient one. So how do we change the price signals in order to get that outcome. And so that's what we're focused on. And it's far from straightforward and had never been done before. So I guess I see this in a lot. I've seen this now in a lot of contexts, but the amount of time spent dealing with internal politics and disagreements kind of overwhelmed everything, so that this change that we were all trying to do was, I felt, sputtering out to some degree. And, you know, I guess if there's any disappointment, I think it would be, I wish it was easier to agree and move forward more often, and we could spend less time on internal politics and more time on what we're trying to deliver.
You mentioned earlier that one of your ambitions or goals was to impact change through the work that corporations do, and that corporations actually transcend borders. And is this the reason you changed from the public sector to now where you are today? You're now at Tesla. Can you help us understand how that transition from the public sector to the private sector?
Yes. So that's definitely part of it. And I guess something that I've experienced throughout my life is, you know, I have an interest, and sometimes it'll be a very specific one. And when I was in coming out of my internships and going into law school, it was corporate social responsibility. And I really saw that as like, that can make a big difference. And then I had an experience with it and felt like, okay, I don't think this is tied enough to a bottom line, and there's got to be another way. And so the direction of impact would always evolve. My decision to go to the private sector and end up in Tesla has, you know, kind of many components to it. But, one piece was in working for the state. It was wonderful. But I felt like my learning curve had ceased to be a curve. It was just very flat. And I loved the people that I worked with more than anything. But I knew that I needed a new kind of challenge. I like very steep climbs. And I also really wanted to be a part of the change in a different way. We were developing the rules so that innovators would come and deliver the solutions. We weren't going to pick the winners. And so then I wanted to get on the other side and be a part of the solution in that way. And so I actually left my job and did not know exactly where I was going to go next. I needed to give myself some space. But there were a few companies that I had met along the way that I really believed they could do it. They would do it. And Tesla was one of them. And they were, as the time when I was coming out of government, they were just starting their energy business. And it was specifically energy storage, which would be batteries that would enable you to store solar energy. I mean, you can store any electricity in it. And it's essential for a 100% renewable world, but it also has a lot of benefits before that point. And I was drawn to Tesla because it very much speaks to how I think we'll change things for the better. It's as number one thing, Tesla is just tries to make a great product and you don't have to care about the environment. You just have to want, you know, a great car. And then underneath it is something that's good, good for society. And so, you know, I think, you know, that's part of what I want to do. And so I was very attracted to the company, and actually, along the way, had met the guy who had helped start the energy business at Tesla. And so I reached out to him. He didn't initially respond. And then it turns out I had a good friend who was friends with him. So I went through him and then he responded. And I got a chance to pitch him on a strategy. And they liked it and hired me.
What was the strategy?
Well, it was how they how to develop their energy business on the East Coast. And
so they hired you to go and do that?
They hired me to go and do it.
That's what you're doing now.
Yes, yes.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
How do you, what are the things you need, the components you need to go and step into this? I guess it requires a bit of confidence to go and say, okay, so this is a large company. It's a company that is admired, you know, by the world, by the markets right now. It's a huge company now. It's not only a car company, it's an energy company. And you go and say, okay, I'm going to just come up with a strategy. I'm going to find my way in and convince them that it's the right thing to do. Like, what are the things that, now looking back at this process, what are the things that made that work?
The thing that made it work for me in this moment was, I mean, what I pitched them on is something that I'd been working on for years. And so I wasn't, you know, kind of making something up just to get a job. And the other companies, there was another, actually a German company that I had a similar experience with, and it was very much, this is what I believe, this is what I know, and this is what I can do for you. And I think, you know, spending that time to really, even if it's in an area that you don't know as well, spending the time and really coming up with something that you think you want to do, you can add unique value to, and you know, can speak to them. And I mean, so much about it is timing. I mean, they at the time, and I didn't know this, but you know, they were just starting to build out their energy business, and they had about 40 people max on the business side, and no one. I did know they had no one on the East Coast, which I thought they were missing an opportunity. So it's again like kind of doing the work and knowing your stuff, but also kind of the timing piece of it is, you know, is essential. So I mean, shortly after I was hired, there was a hiring freeze, and then, you know, after I was hired to do this, there was an announcement that we were acquiring SolarCity, which is a 13,000-person energy company. So, you know, getting the job is exciting, but then in whatever environment we end up in, the world changes. And you have to kind of, my job has changed probably 5 times since I was hired. And I think the ability to roll with that and to try to make out of it what you need and want is important.
Fast change is going to be the predominant dynamic, I think, in the next, you know, 10 to 15 years or in this changing economy, which means that the things we learn today or the things we do today will likely change soon. So for people in the workplace, what do you think are the foundational skills that people need to master that they can transcend into other roles or throughout these different roles? You mentioned you had multiple roles at Tesla, only at Tesla. So what are the things that will never change? What are the things that will always be important regardless the context you're in?
I think being open-minded and able to learn in a new area quickly. I mean, a lot of people get very stuck and say, well, this is what I do. And, you know, I worry for those people because that thing that you do might not exist tomorrow. Or somebody else might get hired and you need to figure out how else can you add value. And so I don't know if it was my experience in law school or how I was raised, but I kind of take my analytical skills and can, I feel like I need to learn a new area. I need to do a new thing. That's great. Not a problem. I mean, it feels uncomfortable sometimes, but I think kind of being open and willing to learn in a new area and giving yourself, no matter how many years you've been in one discipline, giving yourself the space to do that and not get upset with yourself is important.
This show is called Role Models. Who is your role model?
I would say my grandmother's. I'm very lucky. I'd say my grandmother's and, you know, my parents have been amazing. But I also, professionally, I have probably one male and one female. I'd say, you know, Richard Kaufman is a real mentor of mine, and a role model, and a woman, Cheryl Martin, who I got to work with briefly in the state, who, again, she was, I think, a chemical engineer and worked in some large corporations, worked for government, and was just kind of always being true to herself professionally. But the thing that especially those two have in common is how much they respect people and colleagues. And I value that over everything.
How do you find a mentor?
That's a good question. I guess I sought them out. I mean, Richard, I met him once and, you know, wanted to work with him. And, you know, similar, I guess, with Cheryl. I met her and Richard had introduced us and we were trying to recruit her. She also at first said no. And then I got to work with her. So, you know, I think whenever we meet people along the way that make us look at something a little bit differently, try to find some way to be in their life in some way.
Sounds like your approach is to go and hire your mentor.
Yes. Yeah.
What advice would you give your 14-year-old self?
Trust yourself. That's my, usually my kind of gut instinct is right for me. But then I struggle with, you know, I still do, struggle with, well, I should do this and this is what these other people would do. And so I think kind of trusting myself more.
Do you have developed over the years a practice to, not let the voices in your head overshadow the gut feel?
I have, but it's, I could improve on it.
What is it?
Well, no, I mean, I spend a lot of time, kind of working through the questions. And you know, I'm very thoughtful before I act.
Do you write it down, or do you have a certain practice that works best for you?
I write in a journal. It's very free form. And as I get closer to needing to make a decision, if it has to do with changing jobs or moving or whatever it is, I'll kind of start doing pros and cons lists, but eventually working through it so that it's a mixture of analysis and emotion.
For listeners who feel stuck, either in their careers or making big life changes or, other big decisions, or for people who have doubts to follow and pursue their dreams, the things they know they want to do, but something, a power is keeping them from doing that. What do you tell them?
One thing would be to dig inside yourself and really explore those feelings. And another is to talk to other people and to find maybe other people who are going through similar things because they're out there. I mean, when I left my job with the state, a friend gave me a book called Leap. It was about leaving a good, a good career, not knowing what's next. And, you know, everybody's saying, what are you doing? You must be lost and all these things. And, people were saying that to me too. And at that point I knew exactly what I wanted to do, but, I needed to take a non-traditional way to get there. And, I think it's a great book actually for people to read or skim, as they're trying to get to the next phase of their lives. But, you know, it talked in there about setting up time with other people who are kind of going through the same thing, and creating that community for yourself.
Where do you go for advice?
I go to, I go to my closest friends. They all have play different roles. I go to my sister and to my parents, and as a good New Yorker, I have a therapist.
What is the best piece of advice you've received from your mom?
She's given me a lot of great advice. Keep fighting, be true to yourself. She's a fighter. I think both of my parents have actually kind of transformed themselves and their careers multiple times. I've watched them go from being at the top to starting something totally new and being, you know, a 60-year-old intern, basically, because they wanted to learn in a new area and try to excel at it. And so watching them go through that and all of the emotions within it has been incredibly helpful for me. And I think just, keep fighting.
I think that's a great way to end. Okay, thank you so much for taking the time. It's a fascinating career. All the best to you at Tesla, and thanks again for sharing.
Great, thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening. Before you go, here's a few more things. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Role Models Podcast on SoundCloud, iTunes, and your favorite podcasting app. If you'd like to support, please rate this podcast on iTunes and post a review. This will help other listeners like you find this podcast. And if you have any feedback for us or suggestions for who you want to have on the show, please let us know and reach out on Twitter @RoleModels. Thanks.